From the deepest ocean to the jagged peaks of the world's highest mountains, get ready for an adventure into the wonder and excitement that is our planet. Today, we'll dive to the bottom of the ocean in search of shipwrecks with the man who discovered the Titanic. Then we'll visit post-Katrina New Orleans. See if the Big Easy is prepared for another hurricane. And we'll go to an unlikely refuge in the Persian Gulf to chase the fastest cats on Earth. This is National Geographic Weekend. Have you ever wanted to go where man or woman has never gone before? That's the great thing about National Geographic Weekend. We actually take you on expeditions to places that people have not seen or explored before. But we do it without you having to suffer the hypothermia or the altitude sickness or any of the other problems that come with the real exploring. Because we let you sit in the comfort of your home and listen to the explorers who are doing the dirty work for you. And we have one of the great National Geographic explorers, explorer in resident, Dr. Robert Ballard, joining us on the show. Bob, welcome.
Well, it's a pleasure. I'm really excited about this new program.
And you've just gotten back from an expedition in the Black Sea. And did you find anything?
This particular expedition, we were going back to two ancient shipwrecks that we discovered, one actually as recently as last year, in the anoxic layer. Black Sea is a very unusual body of water. It's like no other body of water in the world in that at depth it has no oxygen. All the rest of the world's oceans have oxygen. But because there's no oxygen, an ancient shipwreck can be perfectly preserved, and we found one that's still sitting on the bottom with its mast sticking up. It's quite dramatic.
When you go back, what is it that you're looking for that you didn't see when you discovered it?
Well, you know, we wanted to find out, because we've never actually excavated a shipwreck. We've gone around and discovered them all over the planet, but we've never actually done the chore of sitting there day in and day out and actually excavate the ship. And we wanted to see, A, if we could do it, because no one's ever done it. I mean, we're working in thousands of feet of water. And number two, was the ship as preserved as we had hoped? And the answer was unbelievably preserved. And so we're going to come back now, review everything we did, where we went beyond what we thought was possible, and now plan the next incredible mission next year.
And when you say excavated, are you taking things that were inside the ship, whatever cargo it might have been carrying?
Yes.
And you're bringing that to the surface?
Some of it. In fact, we're also building an underwater museum around each of the shipwrecks. And instead of bringing everything up, we're actually building underwater storage facilities, which we did, and we're storing them in those facilities so that when we go back, we'll actually have an underwater museum.
How deep is this?
Well, the deepest spot was a little over 1,000 feet. We've been exploring down to the bottom of the Black Sea, which reaches 6,000 feet. But the particular perfectly preserved shipwreck off Turkey that we just finished hours ago is over 1,000 feet down.
So when you have a ship and a museum 1,000 feet down, how's anybody going to visit that?
Because you wire it. You just wire it. First place, we did this whole expedition live. So if you were watching our website, you would have seen it 24 hours a day, high-def images coming up from our robots, two robots that were working simultaneously together, and we displayed that on the web the whole time. Now what we're going to do is we're going to actually select particular sites and actually run cables to them and provide remote access to them. We've been doing that actually for several years in the National Marine Sanctuary just to demonstrate that we can. I have a camera system in the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary in California that I can actually operate anywhere in the world at a secret website. I can go in and operate that camera. So we've demonstrated we can do it.
And we're talking with Dr. Robert Ballard, undersea explorer, National Geographic explorer in residence, about some of his most recent work in the Black Sea. And does this mean eventually people will just be able to log onto a website at any time, any time, day or night, and look at this museum where you've place the artifacts or in a visible way around these ships?
Ultimately, my dream is to wire up the Titanic. You said at the top of your program how people can sit in the comfort of their living room and go on our expeditions. Well, we really can deliver that. We can really not only let them listen to it, we can give them actual control of our robots. I could actually give you right now. I better not. I'll get in trouble. But I could give you the website of one of our underwater camera systems, and you could operate it.
And eventually, that will be available.
Absolutely.
Oh, that's exciting.
The whole idea is we're really moving into an era of electronic travel, where you have in your home. We're using a new web called Internet 2. Now, it's in all the major universities in the United States, and it's starting to creep out of the universities into schools. And I have one, I'm sitting at one right now that I've been using. But Internet 2 makes the Internet 1 that everyone is so excited about look like a dirt road on the information highway. With Internet 2, you get 10 gigabits of bandwidth. It's like drinking information from a fire hydrant, the volume you can bring out of it. So what's going to happen is you're going to have in your home, when I2 comes into your house, it's going to change your life. And one of the things it's going to permit you to do is to rent robots from Hertz or something and go on the Serengeti on Saturday morning and actually do your own exploration. And that is not science fiction. It's something that we're doing right now, and it's just a question of time when it becomes available to more people.
This is going to let everybody be an explorer.
Exactly.
In any area where they have an interest.
Exactly. I mean, that's what the world's getting wired. And nowhere will you be more than a quarter of a second away on the planet. I mean, it'll make the planet seem a little smaller, but it'll certainly make it accessible. And the beauty of it is it doesn't require you to physically go there, because most of the damage that's being done to these wonderful places is by people coming and tramping around and having to be fed and having, you know, going to the bathroom and doing all the things that are negative to the environment. You won't be doing that because you'll be physically, you'll be in your home. But your eyes and your mind and your spirit and everything will be out in the wild. And what's also wonderful, we've installed these underwater cameras in Monterey Bay, for example. When we first went in, all the animals run away, okay? And then we install the cameras, and actually an underwater robot that glides along on a wire, and the animals accept it because it never leaves. It becomes a part of their home, and then the animals come out of the wild. And so you see things you would never see if you went down in a scuba tank, because they can just run away. Well, this is what we can do in Yellowstone Park. How many people go to Yellowstone and never see a wolf pack? Well, with these remote technologies, you'll be able to watch the wolf packs and see things you couldn't see if you were physically there.
Bob, you've been at the forefront of bringing technology to exploration, and that's what's really changed, because when you were first doing it, you had to go yourself to the bottom of the ocean.
Absolutely.
You had to get in a tiny little submersible,
yeah.
and that's not completely safe. Because
it's not only not safe, because I almost got killed several times. It's definitely not super safe. I mean, but more importantly, it's extremely expensive. And I say the most important thing is you have to come up right away. It's, you know, when you dive down, I physically have dove down to over 20,000 feet under the ocean. It took me 6 hours to get down to 20,000 feet, 6 hours to get up. I was exhausted before I arrived. So the bottom time was measured in minutes, not hours. The average depth of the ocean is 12,000 feet. That's a five-hour round trip. Average bottom time, if you're lucky, is 3.5-4 hours. So the point is that this new technology, you can go down and stay down. There's no reason to bring your robots up, and you can get up and go to the bathroom. You can go and have some lunch and come back, and you're still down there. And that's what we've been doing for the last month. I mean, I've been on the bottom of the Black Sea for the last month. We just surfaced this morning after continuous exploration, 24 hours a day. And anyone that tuned in was with us, so we can get millions of people on these expeditions. But yet you don't have that intrusive nature of having a million people, you know, stumbling around in the wild, scaring all the animals away.
We're talking with Bob Ballard, explorer in residence for the National Geographic Society on National Geographic Weekend. And we've talked a lot about this future that is actually the present. It's already arrived. But I want to talk just a little bit about some of the past exploration you've done, because Bob found the Titanic and did not set it up as a museum, and a lot of people have been going down there in person since.
Yeah.
And I want to talk to you about that when we return. So stick with us. We'll be right back with Dr. Bob Ballard on National Geographic Weekend. We're back on National Geographic Weekend with Boyd Mattson, and we're doing a little exploration today. We're exploring the bottom of the ocean with Dr. Robert Ballard, a National Geographic Explorer in Residence, and he has found some exciting things. I mean, to say you were the first to see something once in your life is a miracle, but to be able to say it again and again and again and again and again, Bob has. He's seen the first to find numerous shipwrecks, which got the most attention, the Titanic, the Bismarck, the Lusitania, ships in the Battle of Midway, now ancient sailing ships in the Black Sea. But also, you were the first to see the new sea vents, or to see sea vents down there and these new life forms, weren't you, Bob?
That was an amazing. Yeah, there was a group of us in 1977 that were exploring an undersea mountain range north of the Galapagos Islands and came on this lost world of creatures that no one had ever seen before, characterized by these giant tube worms.
It actually told us something about outer space by looking at the bottom of the ocean.
Well, it gave us
an insight into how life could exist without light or oxygen.
Yes. No, it really rewrote the biology books. I mean, we had been taught in school that, you know, life was totally dependent upon photosynthesis and that, you know, without photosynthesis you couldn't have life, and yet here we found a system operating in total darkness, and we discovered that a bacterium living in the bodies of these creatures had figured out over eons of time how to replicate the process of photosynthesis in the dark, living not off the energy of the sun but the energy of the earth itself. So it really, really shook people up. It's now helped to explain the origin of life on our own planet, but as you said, it's given us a key to search for life elsewhere in the universe and even within our own solar system.
Could this be an explanation for the talk of perhaps there was life on Mars or some strange form of life on Mars?
Oh, I think most people believe that life probably did exist on Mars. We don't know how intelligent it was, but there's no doubt that it more than likely did. We even think it still may. What we're discovering here on planet Earth is there's a huge amount of life in Earth, in this great mountain range, living inside the mountain range. And so because of that, we're now looking back at Mars, saying, you know, we look for life on Mars, but we never look for life in Mars, and this is now driving their research, driving their exploration, looking for water, looking for heat sources, and probably they'll drill down inside Mars and they will find the same extremophiles, this bacteria that can live under extreme environments. So I suspect most people would bet good money that there's life still on Mars, but in it.
Before the break, we mentioned about the Titanic and the fact that you discovered it, told the world, it was a great announcement, but you also told everybody where it was, and now that's become a business, taking people to the Titanic.
It was a joint discovery between the United States and France, and initially we agreed not to exploit the ship, but France changed their mind. I didn't give the coordinates away. They knew the coordinates. They were on the ship when it was discovered. We just had a different philosophy. I felt that because I'm a futurist, because I saw where we're headed with the technology, I did not see the need to physically bring stuff up. First place, there wasn't really anything to be learned from it. I mean, it wasn't an archaeological site. We know exactly what was on the Titanic, and even the plates don't say Titanic. They say White Star Line, just like its sister ship, the Olympic, and its sister ship, the Britannic. So we didn't see the value, nor did the major museums of the world. We went to the Smithsonian. We went to the British Museum. We asked, you know, does it serve any value to bring anything up? They said, absolutely not. We talked to the survivors and to the people who lost family, said, don't bring anything up. Everyone in the world we talked to said, leave it where it is and appreciate it in place. It's very much like, you know, Arizona and Pearl Harbor. You don't bring belt buckles up off the Arizona. You don't go to Gettysburg with a shovel. There are certain sites that are special sites that you treat respectfully. And that was our philosophy, remains our philosophy. And we also believe that, again, as we talked earlier in the program, we're going to have museums down there, and one of them will be the Titanic someday.
Talking with Dr. Robert Ballard, undersea explorer, longtime connection with the National Geographic Society. And when I first started with National Geographic, we went out on an expedition together on the NR-1, this small nuclear submarine. We went to two shipwrecks. We went to the Andrea Doria, fairly recent one, and we went to the Republic. And they're not very deep, but
spooky.
it was kind of a test of using this nuclear submarine to find shipwrecks, because it could dive deep, and it also could drive on the bottom of the ocean. It had two tires.
Yep.
I can't even remember what was the crew size. 7.
Well, they have 11 people.
11.
And two observers, you and I.
Well, they had that hammock hanging in the little walkway, so you had to crawl under somebody who's sleeping. So it's this tight little thing, and then beneath the command center, beneath where the guy who's piloting the submarine, you could crawl underneath the floor and lie on your belly underneath and look out two little portholes.
Actually, there were three.
Three. Okay.
One in the center and then one to either side, yeah.
You and I were on our bellies under the floor, lying there looking out at these two ships. And I remember we could sort of see, I guess we were on the Republic. We were driving along on the ground.
Well, actually, the Andrea Doria. I remember, because we were driving along, visibility was terrible. There had been a storm, and it kicked up the bottom. I remember going along, and I asked the captain, where is it right now? And there was thump.
But we ran into it.
It went thump. He said, right there. I'll never forget that. There it was. We started doing it by braille.
I'm glad I got to spend a little time on that submarine, because it was an extraordinary experience. And one thing we did, probably a lot of people know this, but every 33 feet you go beneath the surface, you add a lot of pressure, atmosphere.
You add another atmosphere every 33 feet.
So we wrote our names and the dates on styrofoam coffee cups and put them in that little space between the pressurized hatch and the other hatch.
Bearing, right. So it felt pressure.
So it got all the pressure.
Yeah.
And we dove with the coffee cups in there. And then when we came back to the surface, because of all the pressure, all the air had been squeezed out of the styrofoam.
Yeah, thimbles.
Yeah, they were the size of thimbles.
Sometimes we take those styrofoam heads. They're even better. it's pressure's bad down there. I mean, in the Marianas Trench, it's 8 tons per square inch. I mean, it really would ruin your day.
It's a great illustration of why you can't just go down there
exactly
on your own. This is what would happen to your body.
That's right, and that's, again, why I love the robots, because what you can do with them is flood them with oil and all their innards, and if you get oil inside of them, then they don't squish, because the pressure only affects the gaseous state. So it's a way in which we can get around pressure by operating in fluids.
And that's why it's so exciting, this new technology you've been talking about, and the way that everybody, not just scientists, not just people with PhDs, not just college professors, anybody who wants to explore will be able to do this in the future.
They do it now, and if they just tune into our websites when we're on a live expedition.
Well, you've brought it to life for us. Dr. Bob Ballard, thank you for joining us on National Geographic Weekend. It's always great to talk to you, and I look forward to seeing you soon.
Anytime.
Stay with us, folks, because we're going to take a little visit to New Orleans, just coming up on National Geographic Weekend with Boyd Manson. You're back on National Geographic Weekend, and we have with us Joel Bourne, who's just written an article in the current National Geographic magazine about New Orleans and the state of the city. It is such an important city in America's life, and I know in my own life, I love this city. I used to go there, I have to admit it, I used to go there for Mardi Gras, and for the food and the music, it just seemed like this was Americana because it was such a rich blend of cultures, and it all worked so well. Joel, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Board.
And you've written about this city, and to me, it's just heartbreaking what happened to it. And this is what's stunning to me. Parts of the city that you mentioned in the article are now 17 feet below sea level.
That's right. It's incredible.
That means it doesn't stand a chance.
Well, those sections don't. Now, you know, roughly half of the city is at or below sea level. The other half is at or above. The entire pre-Katrina population could very easily live in the areas of the city that did not flood, as long as we rethink and re-envision what New Orleans can be.
First of all, Katrina wasn't a surprise, as you point out in the article. Since the city was first established, it's had a 289-year history of floods. 27 times it's been flooded, so that's about once every 11 years. So we knew this was coming. But somehow, people just believed that we had advanced with our technology that we were going to prevent it. We didn't prevent it this last time, and I get the sense from reading your article, you don't think it's been brought back to that we're going to prevent it from happening again.
No, and it's very long, almost 300-year history. After every flood, there was a fairly typical and rational reaction. They would raise the levees about a foot and basically go back to their lives as normal.
And as your article points out, to bring it back, to sort of guarantee people a sense of safety, it is going to be one expensive project.
Well, that's very true. You're looking tens of billions of dollars and decades to build.
And here's the problem when you say decades to build. Mother Nature doesn't wait. The hurricanes are coming, and they're coming every year, and they're not going to sit around and say, all right, we'll give it a 10-year break, and then we will strike.
Well, and unfortunately, we're entering into a period of heightened hurricane activity. People who study hurricanes, and we talked to a few in the story, have noticed these multi-decadal cycles of increased hurricane activity and then and a period of relative calm, all of which does not bode well for a vulnerable city like New Orleans.
Joel Bourne, writer for National Geographic Magazine, with the article on New Orleans and the August issue of National Geographic Magazine. I want to go back to remembering when hurricanes, we thought of them nothing more than a good drink on Bourbon Street, but I'm afraid that's not totally in the future. Thank you for joining us on National Geographic Weekend. Good talking with you.
Thank you, Board.
Since we've been talking about the impact of Katrina on New Orleans, it takes us into this topic of extreme weather. And really, there's no better person to talk to about extreme weather than Tim Samaras, who is a National Geographic Emerging Explorer, but also a severe storm researcher, which means you go looking for trouble. Tim, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks. Good to be here.
And you do. You go looking for the worst weather you can find, and when you find it, you call it good.
Well, yeah. I mean, certainly everybody's got their definitions of good. Mine is actually finding the tornado, which is an extremely difficult task.
And you've actually put a video probe right in the spot where the tornado came that gave us the inside look at a tornado.
Correct. We actually got probes, and we get out there in the path of the tornado, set the instrumentation in place, and obviously get the heck out of the way before the tornado passes.
Hopefully. This is the question that's on everybody's mind right now. You're listening to National Geographic Weekend, and we're talking to severe storm researcher Tim Samaras. Do you see, from your research, weather getting worse? And that's what we keep hearing reports of, but do you see evidence of that?
Well, maybe not exactly getting worse, but what we found the last 10 to 20 years, if that's any gauge of what's the current trends are, we find that tornadoes are happening more frequently in the northern tier of states, say from Kansas northward.
We're not in tornado season right now, so what do you do in your downtime? What do you look for?
We're back home. We reorganize, bring out a different set of instrumentation, and now we're actually looking and photographing and measuring lightning.
Whoa. Ben Franklin, at
well,
work.
Well, gosh, I hope I'm not doing something as goofy as Ben Franklin. But what we're doing, we're actually photographing lightning like you've never seen it before.
I don't know what it is about lightning pictures, but I love those.
There's certainly a draw to that, and watching lightning in the nighttime sky is certainly unmistakable. And I think everybody, every walk of life, will actually stop and watch the display of lightning.
We can hardly wait to see the pictures.
Well, me too.
So good luck hunting, photographing. We want to get a charge out of your work without actually getting electrocuted. I think that's the bottom line.
Well, and I certainly don't want to get a charge out of either. I just want to enjoy it.
Tim Samaras, a severe storm researcher, thanks for joining us on National Geographic Weekend.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, as you just heard, for some people, their work involves chasing tornadoes. But we're going to meet someone whose job it is to chase the fastest cats on the planet. And they have to catch them. How do they do that? You'll find out when National Geographic Weekend returns right after this. Welcome back to National Geographic Weekend with Boyd Mattson. I don't know why, but it seems like I've spent a lot of time with cheetahs in the last couple of months. Not many people can say that. There are not a lot of cheetahs around. They are a threatened species. But one of the great cheetah outreach programs in the United States is in Cincinnati. And I just got back from South Africa where I was playing with some young cheetah cubs. So you expect to do that in Southern Africa. But what you don't expect to find are cheetahs outside of Africa. Right now we're joined by Luke Hunter with the Wildlife Conservation Society, who has been working with cheetahs in, of all places, Iran. Welcome to the show, Luke.
Thanks, Boyd. It's great to be here.
These are the Asiatic cheetahs. At one point, cheetahs were all over the place. And so why are they still in Iran? How have they managed to survive there and not elsewhere outside of Africa?
Boyd, you know, that's a great question. You know, you're absolutely right that cheetahs used to be much more widespread and used to occupy, you know, quite a lot of Asia, all of the Middle East and Central Asia across to India. And now we're left with this one tiny little population left in the central part of Iran. And I think, you know, I'm sort of guessing because they're so poorly known, but I think there's probably two reasons. One is that it's an incredibly underpopulated part of Iran. So it's amazingly arid and barren and not particularly productive country, not the sort of country that you'd normally expect to find cheetahs in at all. But I think that's worked a little to their advantage because, you know, it's the sort of area that people are not necessarily that interested in. So there aren't that many people there, which has provided a bit of a refuge for the cheetahs.
And there are not many cheetahs either. When we say there's still cheetahs there, they're
that's
what?
Right. Yeah, probably fewer than 100 animals, and that's, you know, again, is a little bit of a guess, but our best data and surveys indicate that it's probably no more than 100 adults, so a tiny little population.
You're listening to National Geographic Weekend, and we're talking with Luke Hunter, biologist with the Wildlife Conservation Society, and are you in charge of the Big Cat Program? Is that your...
Yeah, that's right, the director of the Great Cats Program at WCS.
You've now managed to put radio tracking collars on two of them. One thing we all know about cheetahs, this is the fastest land animal. They can run in a sprint that nobody can catch up to. What is 60, maybe 80 miles an hour, they say, on a sprint. So the question is, you've collared two of them. How do you catch them to collar them? And when they're not that many to start with.
That's right. That was a huge challenge. We weren't even sure whether we'd succeed. And we did surveys, you know, with camera traps and various other technologies to really work out where the cheetahs were and how many there are. And what that enabled us to do is target some areas that we thought were sort of fairly relatively high traffic areas for cheetahs. And these are the areas that we decided would sort of be the hotspots for cheetah traffic. And we caught them there. We used an ingenious device, a foot snare, a very humane foot snare that just catches and holds the cheetah by the foot long enough for us to be able to tranquilize it and fit the radio collar.
So you have to be there to watch to make sure that as soon as it's caught, that you're there to put the collar on and release it from the trap so it's not sitting in a trap for a week or something.
Exactly. That's right. We camp out, and in fact, each of those foot snares actually has a radio transmitter on it that changes signal. It's running continuously, so we know that it's working properly, and it actually changes signal the moment that the foot snare is triggered, which, you know, immediately gets us out of our sleeping bags. And you know, Iran, during this period that we trap, is freezing. The winters are absolutely freezing. There's snow on the ground in some places, which is, you know, incredible that cheetahs actually exist in areas with snow. But you know, come what may, at any hour of the night when the traps go off, we get up and go and tend to them and see, you know, whether it's just a false trigger, which often happens, or as in, you know, the case with these two male cheetahs, we actually end up catching them.
So how long did you have to put the traps out before you finally caught two cheetahs?
This was the first effort we'd tried this, and we only trapped for a total of about 6 weeks. And the reason that was a relatively short window was just, you know, the Iranian summer just gets much too hot to safely trap. So it was during the cool winter that we did this.
But still, you spent 6 weeks, and it took that long to get two cheetahs.
It actually took a month. I think it took 4 weeks to get the first cheetahs, and they were both trapped on the same night, in different snares, but sort of only a few hours apart from one another. So it took 4 weeks to get those, and then we didn't get any other cheetahs during that period, but we did catch a Persian leopard, a terrific Persian leopard that we also put a radio collar on.
Wow. That's exciting. So you've got these cheetahs, you've got them collared, you're following them. Will it actually make a difference in the cheetah's lives?
Boy, you know, that's a really good question, because we, you know, we weigh very heavily whether or not to use radio collars, and indeed, you know, up until, you know, now, for the sort of first 4 or 5 years, we didn't feel we were ready to go ahead with radio collars. We made that decision because we really are lacking some of the key information that's interesting, not just from the scientific point of view, which has its own interest, but really where we think that will be very critical in helping us make the decisions and helping the Iranians make decisions about how they plan for the conservation of the species. And, you know, that's sort of arisen because the pressures on the areas in which cheetahs live now are really increasing. And I mentioned earlier that they're not particularly productive or fantastic areas, but of course, you know, most of the planet now is under some kind of human pressure, and that's increasing in the central plateau of Iran. So there are, you know, there is mining there for metal there, a new development projects. There's large increasing populations of livestock, you know, and the people that tend them moving into these areas. So we really need to know now very specific information about how the cheetahs use those areas so that we can really advise the Iranian government properly in what's required for planning, you know, a system of parks and reserves and so on, which they're very active at doing. They have a terrific protected area system. We want to make sure that protected area system does a good job of protecting the cheetah and really adhering to the great, you know, the significant land use needs that they have.
What an exciting project. One working with cheetahs, a rare species of cheetah, and to get to go into Iran. I think that would be a fantastic to go into this area that isn't that much seen by outside eyes and look at the wildlife there and film these places and look at these animals that have been sort of off limits to those of us in the West for a while. So it's a great job. Luke Hunter, thanks very much for joining us on National Geographic Weekend. Luke's a biologist with the Big Cat Program with the Wildlife Conservation Society. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Boyd.
Okay, folks, don't go anywhere, because when we come back, we are going to take a look into the future. Now, this is done by somebody who actually gets paid for predicting what's coming up, and he's not using a crystal ball. This is on the up and up. He can tell us fairly accurately what kind of major changes are going to be happening in the coming years. That's when National Geographic Weekend continues, right after this. A little segment here that we will be doing regularly on the program, and it's our crystal ball segment, looking into the future. We have Andrew Zolli with us, who is a futurist, who is also a National Geographic Fellow. you look at reality and from that draw conclusions. And I thought it would be good to kick off with talking about a big change that is happening here in the United States, but all around the world, and that is the intersection of faith and technology.
That's right. In fact, we're about to live through the most religious century in American and, in fact, global history. Technology, rather than just acting as an inhibitor of faith or something that challenges people of faith by changing our worldview and realigning our sense of where we exist in the world, science and technology, and especially technology, has acted as a catalyst of faith around the world.
Meanwhile, Andrew, don't some of these religions rail against technology and modernity?
They do, and then, ironically, they rail against modernity and technology using the very tools of modernity and technology. Take a really radical example. If you take an organization like Al-Qaeda, made up of fundamentalist religious fanatics, that is an organization that couldn't exist without technology. They actually need to produce media, and the very fact that they have the tools of media production and the very fact that you can make a video on your computer is absolutely critical to the spread of Al-Qaeda-like ideologies around the world. Now, at the same time, the big influences are really nuanced all across the board. This is going to be an era not just of the greatest growth of religions around the world, the big ones, Christianity and Islam, the ones that we think of all the time, but it's also going to be one in which technology helps and new scientific insights help foster new religious movements that haven't existed before. And in fact, in contemporary religious movements, including contemporary Christianity, there's a new movement called creation care, which looks at the Bible and finds an environmental message in the Bible. It says, God gave us this planet. It's the only planet we have. We need to take care of it because God wants us to take care of it. That's a different non-scientific rationale for practicing some very, very positive things.
Andrew, thank you for giving us this little glimpse into what's coming up in the future. Thank you very much for joining us on National Geographic Weekend.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Boyd.
How was that for an hour of adventure? You didn't even have to get visas for it. But you were able to go with us as we explored shipwrecks in the deepest ocean. We looked at the center of a tornado. We caught up with some super fast cats. That was all in 1 hour. So thanks for joining us on this grand adventure. For more information, remember, on these stories, you can always stop by our website at nationalgeographic.com. Thanks, everyone, for listening. And also, thanks to my producer, Ben Shaw, who puts all of this together. For the Salem Radio Network, our executive producer is Tom Traddon. And be sure, tune in to our next adventure on National Geographic Weekend.